Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in St. Catharines, Ontario. It's the last day of the CHA annual meeting as part of Congress 2014. And one of the fun things about Congress is not only coming across people who you know, also coming across people who are wildly successful.
And
that's who our guest is today. It's Catherine Rollwagon of Victoria Island University, recently of the Wilson Institute at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sean.
I'm very excited to have you here. You were of the University of Ottawa at one point.
Yes.
And now you're abandoning Ontario and heading out to the West Coast.
Yes.
Just in general, obviously you're very excited.
I'm very excited.
To head to Nanaimo and Vancouver Island University. I'm just wondering for you, because you have a family and you're taking everyone out there, what's that process been like for you?
Well, there was a lot of decisions that had to be made. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when I put on my academic hat, it's very exciting. It's a great opportunity to be at an institution that is itself changing a lot, so I feel like I get a chance to grow with it and be in the history department out there with some really great scholars, John Hind and Cheryl Warsh especially. I'm very excited to do some research with her as well. And then you have to kind of take off your scholar hat and put on your family hat. And we've been in Ottawa for 9 years.
Wow.
And I have to say, when I first started my PhD, there was kind of an agreement that we would just be in Ottawa for a very short time. And then the plan was, we'll go back to Victoria, which was where I did my master's, and we'll live on the island and all that, which, of course, didn't happen. Because when you live in a place and when you enjoy living in a place, as we have enjoyed living in Ottawa, it kind of imprints itself on you. So it's hard. It's really hard to leave Ottawa.
And really, your family sort of grew up there. I mean,
yeah.
You had your two kids when you were in Ottawa, right?
Both my children were born there,
And now you're sort of pulling up stakes and going back. And I know you're at Mac.
Yeah.
You've been staying with your mom.
Yes.
Which has been nice. So you're also leaving family in that respect as well. So.
Definitely, yeah. So. Yeah, all my family is in the kind of greater Toronto area, except my sister in L.A., but... it's going to be a change in that respect as well, kind of taking my children away from their grandparents, which my parents are not entirely pleased with, although they're very happy that I've had this success. So
yeah, and like you said, you were at Victoria, so I mean, you know, you have a feel of the island already, and so I'm sure you still have people out there who you know and
definitely
contact and stuff. So I'm sure you're excited to get back out there for that purpose as well.
Yeah, and things that I definitely missed living in Ottawa, and there's lots of things I'm going to miss about Ottawa too, and about Ontario. I mean, I grew up in Milton, and the weather in the past few days has been so beautiful, and those warm Ontario summer evenings. Mm-hmm. Though you don't really have those on the island, right. You have to wear a sweater. But the flip side is that you can play baseball in January and little things like that I'm really going to enjoy. So
we're thrilled for you. The official position of this show is that we're very excited for you that you're heading out to Vancouver Island, and they're very lucky to have you. Now, I do also want to talk about your research, which is what we do on this show.
Yeah.
So your dissertation was The Market That Just Grew Up, was the title, and it focused on the advent of a teenage culture and consumerism through the 30s into the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I find this really interesting because I don't have kids, but a lot of my friends now have started to have kids. And the notion of consumerism surrounding childhood is really interesting because whenever they have kids, there's an expectation that I'm going to go buy something for the kid, which is fine, and I don't mind doing it. And I have sort of a standard thing that I buy all the time.
Right, right.
So I don't really have to think too much about it. But it's really interesting to me that this and I don't know if it was always this way, but there's this expectation for children that things need to be purchased.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, first of all, like when you're talking about consumerism with respect to children, in terms of methodology, I mean, how do you really study this sort of thing?
This is a great question, first of all. And there's a lot of really interesting conversations and discussions that are going on, very interdisciplinary discussions in departments of child studies and in anthropology and sociology departments, where people are trying to figure out the best ways to study children and thinking about children's agency. You know, to what extent are they actors in the marketplace? To what extent do they get to decide what they buy, what's made for them, those kinds of things? And to what extent are they manipulated by advertising, by corporate marketers who want them to be consumers of a certain type? So these are questions that that certainly shaped my research. It gets even more complicated, I think, when you're doing history, because children's agency in the past, the voices of children, as you know, Neil Sutherland and Mona Gleason and Cynthia Camaccio and others have pointed out, it's difficult to hear those voices. Mm. Children's voices are most often mediated by adults. Mm. So in my own research, I get off the hook a little bit partly because teenagers are a bit older. Mm-hmm. So the question of their relationship to the market is a little bit less controversial, at least in the period I'm studying. At the same time, I find that interesting because then it kind of becomes, for teenagers, I think they're almost expected to start engaging with the market more. So this is a broader question that I'm interested in, but to what extent is engaging with the market part of growing up, part of maturing, right? So what I'm trying to say is, by looking at retailers and marketers and advertisers and their images of teenagers, I kind of get around having to think about too much about the teenagers themselves. So my dissertation is really about an idealized image of the teenager, and how that teenager was. What it meant to be that teenager meant being a consumer.
Well, because one of the things that I do is when I'm teaching pop culture, which I very much enjoy doing, both in the American and the Canadian context, is I talk in the 1920s. I always start in the 1920s, because they're always 20th century courses, and I start after the First World War. And one of the things that I always talk about is the advent of a teenage culture in terms of pop culture, and that these cultural institutions, particularly magazines, view teenagers as a market, and how this is new, at least in the publishing industry, in this time, and definitely sort of the film industry then follows suit.
Definitely,
as it markets towards kids, and I'm curious about how that really speaks to our understanding of what teenagers were, because you know, you have this idea of, you know, 18th or 19th century that the teenager didn't really exist. Obviously, there were years when you were a teenage, but you weren't a teenager in the way we think of it now.
Yes.
So is that really a 20th century phenomenon? And is that switch to this culture, is that really sort of the focus of what you're trying to do?
That switch to this culture is definitely the focus of what I'm trying to do.
Am I right in identifying a tangible change in the 20s and 30s?
There is a tangible change in the 20s and 30s. And I do think this is where the border might start to matter a little bit more, because I do think there's some work done in the American context that shows this happening a bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that, I mean, in the States, happening in the 1920s and then kind of filtering up into Canada potentially.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the tie, or the relationship between what's happening by, you know, cultural producers like magazines and then social and economic changes that are happening, that are also part of that story of why the teenage years come to take on a different kind of meaning than they would have in the late 19th century. There are more working kids in industrializing Canada in the late 19th century than there were before, and then that starts to decline again in the 1920s. So for me, one of the reasons why people in their teens start to become more interesting or more, ripe for the picking, perhaps, to retailers and to advertisers is because they start going to school in greater numbers.
Right.
So they kind of become a captive audience in a sense. And I mean, Mary Louise Adams has said this about when she's looking at heteronormativity after the Second World War. But the high school becomes a laboratory for right. experts who want to study teenagers. And I think in some of the same ways, it becomes a place where advertisers and marketers can talk to kids. Mm. Yeah.
You mentioned this earlier, this notion of finding the voice, though, and mm-hmm. the concept of the stylized teenager. Mm-hmm. And what is there a fear, then, of appropriating their voices and viewing them exclusively through the lens of the advertisers? Because obviously there's a clear purpose for why the advertisers mm-hmm. are doing what they're doing, and perhaps it's not an accurate reflection necessarily of the teenager.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So how do you sort of find that balance between not necessarily appropriating the teenage voice mm-hmm. through this specific medium?
Well, I think I have kind of two ways to answer that, I guess. And one is that I talk a lot about, well, if this was their target audience, let's look at who teenagers were mm-hmm. in Canada at this time. And, of course, the image of the teenager that the retailer is portraying in Eaton's catalogs, in Eaton's promotions, in magazines like the Canadian Home Journal, is exclusively white and most often of kind of Northern European extraction and is often very middle class, although that's a bit more difficult to distinguish. And those teenage consumers who are pictured are also often women. So there is a gendered aspect to this mm-hmm. as well. But I'm also, I want to use this idealized image to kind of critique marketing practices in a way, or to kind of not critique so much as reveal the way that retailers were kind of contributing to the emerging notion after the Second World War that the teenage years were a distinct period of life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a discussion going on among child psychologists and educators trying to decide what is it that happens during the teenage years that's important. And retailers are also saying that, you know, because of what teenagers go through in their teenage years, they have to be spoken to in different ways. Mm. They have to be attracted to products in different ways.
Right.
And we have to make products specially for them.
And how much, though, would that be spurned by the 30s and the Depression, where mm-hmm. advertisers and companies are looking for any revenue stream that they can get, given the sort of worldwide collapse of the economic system to a certain extent?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because there are other campaigns that I've seen where people are just trying to market in ways that are different. Like
right.
the Women's Home Improvement Plan
okay,
was
yep.
one that I've come across, because they advertise by saying, don't buy radios.
Okay.
Buy home appliances.
Okay.
So they're saying, improve your home. Buy appliances.
Right.
This is good for your whole family. Don't buy a radio that's frivolous.
Oh.
Right? So that's a marketing campaign.
Yeah.
That's designed with the context of the 1930s and something mm-hmm. that maybe in the 1920s they wouldn't have done. So how much of
right.
this marketing into teenagers is simply an effort to find a new market in a time mm-hmm. when revenues are really down across the board?
I think that's an important part of it. And it's something that actually, when I'm in the process now of revising my thesis for a book, and something that I need to pay closer attention to is the larger economic forces that are affecting the retail sector.
Right.
Things like the Royal Commission on Price Spreads, and Eaton's was really hit hard, and other department stores, you know, by these reports, by these commissions, by this testimony. And so I, you know, it makes me wonder to what extent the campaigns to kind of, I don't know, endear themselves to young people in Canada came, you know, with a, not necessarily directly as a result, but maybe with an awareness
mm-hmm.
that they needed to secure the loyalty of customers at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely something that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that the teenagers themselves really become the focus for Eaton's anyway, for Simpsons as well, in 1939, 1940. Yeah, so it's kind of as the, you know, I think the Depression played a role, but it's certainly not in the depths of the Depression,
right.
perhaps that happens. Yeah.
Mm. With respect again then to pop culture too,
mm-hmm.
there's, to me, it's really interesting. One of the narratives that emerges in the pop culture stuff is that what you see with the wider dissemination of entertainment is that it provides outlets that challenge traditional narratives of morality in new ways. And one of the themes that, at least to me, as someone who doesn't study teenage culture extensively, is that teenagers want to challenge the authority. And, you know, in the 20s, you have people like Mae West who are openly doing this. And they now, whereas before that's localized to a certain extent, now with something like radio and film,
it really
expands its reach. And maybe then that these kids who always had these inclinations now have an outlet for it in a different way, and it's a way to crystallize then this community. And I'm just curious, like that cultural aspect, I mean, how much is that a product, and not necessarily in the advertising part of it, but in the mass entertainment trying to either reflect or attract these voices?
Well, I think it's interesting that there's this really, there's a struggle among advertisers, and I think among cultural producers generally, that to understand the teenager and to understand why it is that they, you know, don't do what adults tell them, and how can we use that to our advantage in a way to sell them products. And this sense of rebellion, I guess, filters down into the way that, you know, if you tell a teenager that this is what they should buy, then they're probably not going to buy it. So they try to kind of use those aspects of what was understood as child development or psychology, I guess, to their advantage. And then the mass, I mean, this is another thing that I find really fascinating, is the whole visual culture aspect of it. Because I think the image of the teenager, just like the image of the flapper, becomes a sign, you know, that almost anyone with the right, with particular goods, which is particular clothing or makeup, can, to a certain extent, adopt. Not equally, obviously, like, you know, but it kind of takes the image of the teenager, which for me, always when I say the teenager, I think of a girl in a plaid skirt and a sweater and, you know, perhaps bobby socks and saddle shoes or something like that, at least in the early 40s. And it kind of spreads it across a vast area so that girls on the prairies, for example, who didn't have access to the same extent to mass culture as someone living in Toronto, for example, could still find these images in the Eaton's catalog, in the films, in the movies and stuff.
So is it almost there's a homogenization of the teenager?
Well, in advertising, definitely.
Yeah.
And, of course, I haven't done interviews with people who were teenagers in the 1940s and 50s, but I know from census data and from other sources that lived experience was very diverse.
Sure.
And I mean, we're talking about a time in the 1940s when a great number of teenagers did not, a great number of young people didn't attend school past the age of 16, if that, you know, if they could leave before that, then they would, some of them. So this idea, this conflation of the teenager with the high school student is already kind of problematic, because that assumes that everyone is in high school, and that's definitely not the case.
That's something we talked about with Robert Chafe a few weeks ago, talking about Newfoundland. It was obviously a different context, but he was talking about this period in Newfoundland history where people were ashamed of it because they felt that, well, we were stupid and all this. And basically what he was saying with the Truxton and Pollock disaster, with the first African-American ever in St. Lawrence, Newfoundland, and this was a point of shame, the reaction of the people. And what he was saying is that, no, it's not a point of shame. It's just they weren't educated.
Right,
and the reason they weren't educated is because when you were 10 years old, then you went out to the boats and you started fishing, or you went down to the mines. So it's not a point of shame. So in the same respect, that teenage culture that you're talking about wouldn't have existed in 1940s St. Lawrence, Newfoundland, because there's no one's going to high school. So if there's this conflation there, I mean, how do you study then that sort of place? And that awareness is really, I think, really important and really interesting.
Definitely. I mean, I became more aware during, and I am still aware, and I have to always continue to be aware, that what I am really studying is I mean, when I'm looking at the advertisers, it's a very urban, it's a very urban context. Mm-hmm. I can't, and I'd like to be able to speak to the experience of more of other places as well. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the power of the culture is that it does start to reach into those places, mm-hmm. and that young women and young men who weren't necessarily going to high school, but who could still read the magazines, they could still kind of either they could reject that image, mm-hmm. and kind of strike out as many teenagers do and find their own fashion or their own modes of consumption, or they could strive to kind of emulate that, mm-hmm. that model.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find, because your study goes from Depression, war, mm-hmm. And then baby boom.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's a trend through the war where these things are somewhat minimized and there's more of focus on conformity?
I find, a lot of my research focused on Eaton's specifically. Uh-huh. And when you look at Eaton's corporate records and its catalogs and its publicity towards teenagers, it does not, it's relentless.
Okay.
War or no war, okay. It changes, it's channeled, uh-huh. So that in the same way that a lot of patriotic advertising focuses on their duty to the country, the fact that they could go and work on the farms and that would be doing a service, you know, mm-hmm. they should consider joining the agricultural service or whatever, those kinds of things. There's a lot of kind of asking teenagers who are working in the stores to volunteer time, money for the Red Cross, charity donations, those kinds of things. Mm. But in terms of spending money, there's certainly no direct appeals to teenagers to stop spending on clothing, records, right. accessories, anything like that. It's relentless.
But was that image sort of refined into a maybe nationalistic image? Like, are they trying to sell more khakis? For example?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, throughout the Eaton's catalog, when the war begins, you see this change, not just in teenagers' clothing, but, and this would make an interesting paper, maybe. For anyone who's doing the history of fashion, I have a database of about 1,000 entries from Eaton's catalogs, and I'm happy to share it. But they start changing the names of the colors to sailor blue, military red. It's just little kind of rhetorical shifts that are emphasizing their position. Of course, mm-hmm. Eaton's, you know, got right behind the war effort.
Sure.
And so that's interesting. And then they also, suits, of course, because of rations and regulations, eventually suits become a lot more kind of tailored and slimmed down and right. not as
no more double-breasted suits.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But it affects all clothing kind of equally. You also see, I mean, in magazines and such, during the war, young people and more parents, actually, more mothers, I should say, than children, mothers being asked to reuse things, to cut down their own coats, to make their children's coats, those kinds of things. But those are not sacrifices that teenagers are necessarily being asked to make. Specifically, there's no different appeal to them.
Right.
So that's
well in the advertisements, right? There's no appeal.
No, not in the ads or in the program that Eaton's ran for high school students.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I wonder, like, one of the things I didn't show this to my class this year because it was just too long, but I showed a different propaganda war bond thing that was Disney.
Mm.
So Disney would obviously target to a younger.
Yes.
Audience.
Oh, was it the Donald Duck one?
Yeah.
Where his eyes turn into swastikas or?
Where there are dollar signs that morph into swastikas, yes.
I love that.
Yeah. So if you've never seen it, you can Google Donald Duck war bonds and it comes up on YouTube. And the basic point is that if you spend money, you're supporting the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And if you save your money and put it into savings bonds or war bonds, mm-hmm. you're helping the Allied cause. That's the basic point of this. And to me, that's the sort of thing that then is going to counter the images mm-hmm. that Eaton's and such is putting forward, right?
Yes.
So there's a conflict there at some point, and mm-hmm. sort of understanding then how teenagers respond to that would be
fascinating.
Yeah, it would be the next step, right?
Yes, I think so, definitely. And I think Graham Broad's book, A Small Price to Pay, that just came out last fall with UBC, he talks about kind of this conflict from an advertiser's perspective, mm-hmm. pardon me, in that advertisers were kind of being recruited to make these patriotic messages about war bonds and saving, and at the same time they were also advertising products, not just save your money to buy later, but actually advertising, right. you know, this pen will help you write to your husband yeah. overseas, right. or, you know, this yeah. watch is the perfect gift for soldiers. So
there
is this contradiction sure. during the war, and it would be great to figure out or to know more about what teenagers, how they experience mm. that.
Well, there's the Andrew Sisters song, too, Rum and Coca-Cola.
I don't know that
which
song.
It's a really interesting song. There were soldiers based in on a Caribbean island, American soldiers.
Okay.
And so they're based down in the Caribbean, and this songwriter goes down, or this musician goes down as mm-hmm. part of a USO tour.
Okay.
Sees all the guys drinking rum and Coke, mm-hmm. because Coke signed up with the military to supply them
yes.
as an advertising
mm-hmm.
tool. And he goes down, basically steals the tune of a Calypso song that he hears, and writes the lyrics to Rum and Coca-Cola, and the Andrews Sisters put it out in January of 1945. It becomes the number one hit.
Okay.
And you see that connection there, that here's this clear advertising thing for Coke,
mm-hmm.
and then this song that comes out is not necessarily a patriotic song, but there's resonance on the home front, that there's a sense that it connects people then to the war to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that's a perfect example of these two things merging together. There's a consumerism in the military effort.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think I'm fairly certain that they just saw it as kind of a corporate as a corporate involvement, as kind of a, you know, as one of Canada's founding families or whatever. Mm. However, they kind of saw themselves as royalty. So this was just a duty that they did as citizens. But there is really the efforts of companies like Eaton's during the war just kind of reinforced that notion of total war, or the mm-hmm. fact that all of society was mobilized in mm-hmm. that sense. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Now, I think most people who are listening to this, if they're anything like me, would associate the rise of a teenage culture with the baby boom.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are coming to teenage years in the 50s mm-hmm. and into the 60s. And I think one of the notions that comes out is, like, the teenage culture started with Elvis.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, first, before we sort of talk about the consumerism part of it, mm-hmm. I'm wondering, in studying sort of the historiography of this, mm-hmm. where does that notion come from, and why is it so prevalent, do you think?
Well, would you like my baby boom generation friendly answer? Sometimes I put on my Generation X hat and get all anti-baby boom. I think part of it comes from this kind of the size argument, the fact that, I mean, we talk about the snake that swallowed the elephant, or the snake that swallowed the rabbit. No, it's the snake that swallowed the pig, the metaphor of the baby boom. And the pig moves through the snake and stretches it, and everything has to change to accommodate the pig moving through the snake. So to a certain extent, because the baby boom was so big, mm-hmm. and because everything was just that much more, you know, there were that many more teenagers. So I think part of the idea that teenage culture starts with Elvis is just because of the massness of it. The fact that Elvis was extremely popular, and of course there's also the advent of television.
Yes.
That kind of, you know, so not only are there more teenagers participating in popular culture, forming, like, creating culture, and also participating in consumer culture, there's also more dissemination of that culture, so that more people are aware of this teenager, and whether they think it's a good thing or a bad thing, is, you know. But so I think that's kind of where it started, and perhaps some people of the baby boom generation helped to perpetuate it, because there's some work out there that looks at or that supposes that the baby boom generation is kind of the most important generation in that sense. So, of course, they invented teenage culture. Of course they did.
Sure. in a pure numbers way to look at it, it makes sense that with this with the baby boomers that people would start to market to them.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that's just economic sense. That there's this huge demographic of people who
supply and demand. Yeah.
Right? That's 101 right there.
Yeah.
But is there any other noticeable change in the post-war period of how people are trying to market to these kids? Is there, again, this notion, I think, you know, baby boomers sort of have the idea of sort of starting the counterculture and that.
Yeah.
Does that sort of stuff come through in the advertising?
Not in this period. Mm. I should clarify. Advertisers from a very, like, throughout the period that I'm looking at, throughout the 40s and 50s, see young people as going against the grain, in a sense. They don't, it's different from the 1960s, and they don't see them as rebelling against society, but they do see them as difficult to figure out, or not, unpredictable, definitely, in that sense. But what's interesting about the 1940s and 50s is that advertisers seem to spend a lot of time convincing themselves and other adults that teenagers are responsible, economically powerful, autonomous, ready to be, free from parental influence, which is interesting. So kind of asserting the agency of the teenager to be a consumer in their own right.
Right.
So they kind of, you know, they're kind of reinforcing the teenager's independence because, as a consumer. And I think that's partly because that legitimizes their advertising efforts. You know, if the teenager is not a child, then they don't need necessarily as much protection from what some people saw as the corrupting influence of the marketplace. Mm.
But so, it also then does not speak as well to, you know, teenagers tend to want that independence.
Definitely,
right? So you're speaking right to them and saying, we acknowledge your independence.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's an advertising tool.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I don't know if they, this is what's really hard to figure out in kind of corporate speak or industry speak, because you have Eaton's publicity, things that they published either in the newspaper or press releases, those kinds of things, and then you have their records, their files, kind of the back door or back room operations of what was happening and how they were trying to figure out the teenager. So I don't know if to what extent they were conscious that legitimizing teenage freedom would be a really good strategy, but it did work. I mean, from the records I've found, a lot of some of the young people that worked in the stores that were part of their youth councils, they said, "Wow, Eaton's talked to us as if we're adults. You know, this is great. They take us seriously," and so it works in that respect. Yeah.
But at the same time, I guess there has to be sort of a wink and a nod to the parents, because that's where the money is coming from to buy these things, right? So where's that balance found between I want to speak to the teenagers directly, acknowledge their agency, acknowledge that they're independent consumers, but at the same time, I can't do anything that's going to upset the parents because the parents need to provide the money.
We need to provide the money. And this is, that's a great question, because parents are virtually absent in a lot of this advertising. They just don't, you know, make it to the, I don't know. When Eaton's talks to teenagers, the parents just aren't there. So there is that assumption that perhaps teenagers have their own money. Now, whether that is coming, I mean, in a lot of cases, I think it was coming from parents, from an allowance or whatever.
Yeah.
They didn't feel the need necessarily to justify that to teenagers anyway. But then I'm wondering, and this is part of my next research question, where did the money come from?
Right.
So looking at teenagers' part-time work and how many teenagers, and I don't think it was a vast number of high school students, but a growing number who had part-time jobs, who were in some sense, you know, spending their own money in that, well, spending some of money that they had earned.
Right.
And, you know, so where did that come from? Where did they work? And then what did they do with that money? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the next project.
Well, you wonder, too, if it's almost sort of like a Ford model with the assembly line and where they're sort of, the idea is, especially with suburbanization, you know, you need people to staff these stores.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you hire the teenagers, mm-hmm. and then they're going to shop there.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, definitely.
Same way, so at Ford, you hire these people, they're going to buy my car.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, maybe a similar model in that respect, that yeah. maybe it's not just in the way they advertise, but also in their hiring.
Definitely. Well, it's...
At least for the retail, like the,
for the, oh,
the
yeah.
frontline retail jobs. Mm-hmm.
Danica Belize, she's done some really great work looking at how people who worked at Eaton's were kind of commodified by Eaton's. Their bodies became, you know, they represented the company.
Right.
So they had to be healthy and certain standards of beauty and cleanliness. And they were also considered potential consumers.
Yeah.
But when you look at teenagers, what's interesting is that when Eaton's started these youth councils, where they basically recruited high school students to come to the schools, to come to the store every Saturday and have these little kind of focus group, quasi-educational, learning about the retail world kind mm-hmm. of meetings, they often recruited floor employees out of those pools of teenagers. So it was... The in addition to being a valuable source of information about teenage trends and what teenagers were doing, it was also a way to get into the high schools, and it was also a ready pool of labor and young people who already had, because of this program, a knowledge of the company,
right.
and who were probably, many of them, interested in working. Yeah.
Yeah. That economic element is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to like name anything specifically, but like you see, like charitable things that various companies do now, that you'd like to believe that they're doing it because they really believe in that charity, but then they have 6-week advertising campaigns talking about the charitable work. Right? And I realize that there's a difference between hiring people to shop at your store and having a charity as a
advertising
campaign, but to a certain extent, there's an economic underlying to all this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Everything they do, right? It's all about maintaining your profits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also, I mean, the employees, the teenagers could become employees. You want them to be consumers as well. Mm-hmm. But and you'll make money from them if they become consumers. But you also, if you've already trained them essentially for free because they're participating in this program, then you also, as a company, I guess, you know, you've saved a little bit of time and effort in that in that regard. So that's definitely.
So the study stopped sort of with the end of the 1950s, right? Is that what motivated that break in the study?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to stop. Before the baby boomers reached the age of 13.
Okay.
So if you assume that the baby boom began, you know, 1946 roughly, then it's really kind of 1960 or thereabouts that this cohort starts to reach teenagehood, essentially. So because there has been more attention to teenagers in the 60s, to young people in the 60s, I would argue actually there's a lot more work to be done on high school students in the 60s, in their activism and you know, their lives. But we tend to conflate youth, teenagers in the 60s, political activism, you know, rebellion and such. But yeah, I wanted to stop before the 60s.
Because most of that stuff in the 60s, like a lot of that stuff happens on college campuses.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, I mean, I've heard whispers, and there's probably some scholarship out there that I should know about, about the types of, democratic actions that were happening on high school campuses, because I'm sure a lot of these ideas about more student involvement in curriculum and more student power in the schools, I'm sure they trickle down to high schools. I've heard anecdotal accounts, but so I really want to stop talking about the teenager as a consumer in 1960, because that's when marketers really start to publish, you know, big tables talking about the economic value of this cohort. Mm. They're doing that in 1957. Actually, the title of my thesis, The Market That Just Grew Up, is from a McLean's article in 1957, where they talk about how retailers have just discovered this great, the great potential of teenagers, and it's 1957. Well, really, it was, you know, 15 years before, really, that they started doing this. So that was kind of the point I wanted to make. Yeah.
Now, in general, I had a student come up to me last week as I teach this popular culture in Canada course.
A popular course.
Yes, although it was full before they announced the theme, so I don't know.
Okay.
Limited options in the summer, so it was full, and then they said it's popular culture, and enough people stayed. But he came up and said, I want to do consumerism as my term paper.
Mm.
And I said, okay, that's fine. And he said, where do I start? And I said, I don't know, because it seems to me that it's such a hard thing to do.
Because like when I think Jell-O on a wall,
yeah, because I think of consumerism, I think of purchasing.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're looking at consumerism through the advertising, not so much as the actual purchasing.
Right.
And so I'm wondering exactly what is consumerism as a as a study, in part, so I know what to tell this guy, but is consumerism just about the economics of it, or is there other purposes? Because even in the pop culture context, consumerism is the consumption, right? So I might not be paying for the TV show.
But you're watching
it. But I'm watching, I'm consuming it. So that's an aspect of consumerism.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's not necessarily an economic transaction there in that I'm paying for it. There's an economic transaction in that I'm watching the advertisements.
Right. Yeah.
But there's nothing that I'm shelling out for it. So, I'm just curious if you could help, explain.
help.
Sort of this thing that doesn't sort of jive in my mind
as
to what the study of consumerism actually is.
Right. Well, Sean's student, I'd like to say, it's a really interesting question. And this past year at McMaster, I was privileged to teach 2 fourth-year seminars, actually, one in the fall and one in the winter on, it was a History of Modern Canada seminar, but I taught it as a history of consumer culture in Canada, in mostly 20th century Canada. And one of the first things we do the first day is a reconnaissance of terms. So what is a consumer? What is consumption? What is consumerism? What is consumer culture?
Right.
What is a commodity? All these C words that are often used interchangeably.
Yeah.
And there's been some good some discussion among those who study consumer culture or consumption. They take on different titles about these terms and how they're used by people like Frank Trentman. He's at the University of, I think he's at University College London. Or something. Anyway, and Denise LeBlise, again, she often, a lot of her articles begin with a very clear definition of terms, which I always find really, really useful. And it's one of the reasons why I get my students to read her stuff. But I think because my students, I asked them to write essays, they had to pick a consumer good.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the research had to resolve around a particular material good, and then the history of how that good was either advertised or consumed by consumers, how they bought it, why they bought it, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think consumption is almost, it's almost an approach to a particular, in my opinion, it's often best to approach it as an entree into a particular material item that you're interested in. So if you're interested in television content and who consumes it. See, I don't know if I would put that in the realm of kind of consumer culture.
Okay.
Well, no, consumer culture maybe, but consumer history or yeah, this is interesting.
Well, because there's a clear difference between
an economic transaction
and a non,
and
like,
a non one, yeah.
But even like Sidney Mintz and Sweetness and Power, right? That's about commodification.
Yes, yeah.
And as opposed to say,
giving
consumerism,
something value. Yeah,
right?
There's
a difference between those two things, I would think. But then, could you not argue at the same time then that I'll go back to the television? That television and the programs were commodified.
In a way, yeah. You could. The televisions, well, televisions.
Television as a,
certainly.
The device
yeah,
itself, for
yeah,
sure. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. But the content, yeah, it becomes commodified as well because it has a value that doesn't come from necessarily the content itself. It comes from the society that is consuming it, in a sense. Do you want, should consumer culture only be about economic transactions at the point of purchase? I certainly don't think so. Because, sure. I mean, economics, even in the making of television content, economics is a huge factor.
Right.
And that, I mean, look at the CBC. you need money to make television.
Yes.
But in terms of studying it, I think it's really important to start out by thinking, well, what is it that I'm really interested in? Am I interested in the people who consume either cultural products or material goods, or am I more interested in the people who are selling them? Is it the good itself? I mean, I'm talking about Denise Blaise a lot, but her article towards a consumer history of consumer history of consumer Canada, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit. It's I think it's from 2003. She talks about how one way of approaching consumer culture and the history of consumption is to take one particular material item and follow it through the process, production, packaging,
right.
Retailing, the point of purchase, and then the use of the good. Those are all kinds of different perspectives on one thing,
right.
You know? So anyway, yeah, I don't know if that'll help your student, but this is the other thing. Consumerism can also be taken as a critique of consumer culture,
right?
Which is a whole other. I mean, you can talk about consumer activism and people who have tried to, you know, embrace a counterculture that is not based on the same types of consumer values. So that's often what consumerism means to historians of consumer culture. Yeah,
it's a really broad area.
It is very, very broad and slippery.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really interesting. I find it fascinating.
Oh, okay, I'm glad.
I really do, and especially in the context of trying to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that is, for me at least, is like these big complex ideas are so hard to distill into a lecture that is accessible.
Yes. And which I have yet to do.
It's really difficult.
So I agree.
And for me, I think I have an advantage to a certain degree in pop culture when I can just show the stuff.
Right.
And say, you know, I'm not trying to explain to you necessarily why this is significant. Let's watch it together.
Okay.
And then discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because then it sort of takes me out of it to a certain extent. And
right.
I'll present the underlying theory or the
right.
other thing.
The historical context.
Yeah.
And
we'll say that. And then, but here's the actual content. You consume it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make up your own mind on its
right.
significance, which to me, like the song Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, the Shirelles, which comes out in the 60s, was really important. It's really interesting in that way because I play the song, and the song is about a woman losing her virginity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, is
right.
asking the guy, like, do you just want to have sex,
yeah.
or is this an actual thing?
Yeah.
And she's the song is about the girl asking herself this, and she runs through all the different possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I play that song, and then I say, one, what is the song about? And it's always interesting to see the reactions of what people think the song is about. And then I present the argument that has been made that that's one of the most important songs ever released, because not only is it addressing female sexuality, but it's also a black group.
Mm.
So it's black female singers who are presenting this. And it becomes a huge hit.
Right, right.
So I explain this.
Yeah.
And then we say, is this significant?
Right.
After they've consumed it. And the reactions are always so different between what is significant. So in studying then consumer culture, there's that individual aspect of it as well, because each person is going to experience it differently.
Exactly. And when you buy, you know, in trying to look historically at why people purchased certain things, it becomes very difficult.
Sure.
Without, you know, without even oral history. And I haven't done – I did oral history – interviews in my master's work, but I didn't do any for my PhD, and partly because
too much paperwork.
Well, that's partly because it's too much paperwork. Oh, and finding interview subjects. I mean, who is your target group? Well, it's anyone who was a teenager, and you know, it's a big group.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I think consumption, especially. You'd have to be very interested in specific items of significance to them. So what do they remember,
right.
you know, about what they purchased when they were a teenager? And I think that is an interesting question, and I think it's one that I'd like to explore more. But in trying to figure out this kind of cohesive, this present or try, an attempt to create a market segment, mm-hmm. Which is very much an industry activity. You know, the individual recollections of people about things they might not even remember, because often consumption is very mundane.
Sure.
Like, it's just something we do, like, mm-hmm. you know. So well, how much of that are they going to remember,
right.
is a question. Yeah.
And especially with
yeah.
clothing.
Yeah. I mean,
right?
well,
and that example,
yeah.
I mean, you know, you'll remember buying a car or a
yeah.
house.
Yeah.
You might not remember buying, you know, a pair of pants.
Okay. That's true. A pair of pants.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's funny? I think this is very gendered too, though. And this is just anecdotal. But my mom, I've had discussions with my mom about her wardrobe when uh-huh. she was young. And she grew up in Sarnia in the 50s and 60s. So a little bit, she wasn't a teenager until the 60s. But, you know, she said, when I was growing up, I had a school dress, I had a play dress, and I had a Sunday dress. I had two pair of shoes, you know, very little. Compared to what we think of as a wardrobe
sure.
now, it was a lot smaller and a lot different. And she does remember kind of what constituted her wardrobe, mm-hmm. what important clothing is part of how she tells her story of growing up.
Right.
And to me, that's significant
yeah.
and something worth exploring.
For sure.
But I'm wondering if men have the same memories mm-hmm. to the same extent. Because
right.
Eaton's did a lot of polling of teenagers. And so they asked high school guys. There's this really funny survey where they asked all of these junior executives, as they called their teenage men focus groups. These are the junior executives. There's a whole other thing we could go into there. But they asked them, what do you wear to school? What do you wear after school when you're hanging out? What do you wear on a Coke date, which uh-huh. presumably you're going to the soda bar?
Yeah.
What would you wear to a movie? There's a dozen different situations where they want to know what boys are wearing. And invariably, the answer is, well, it varies a little bit, but mostly it's a sweater and pants. You know, like sweater
right.
and pants, sweater and pants. Oh, if I was going out on, you know, to a dance, okay, I'd wear a suit. But
right.
it's, you know, like, what are they expecting
yeah.
to get? And the boys are not saying, I wear, well, a few of them do, but most of them are not saying, I wear Eaton's pants, this color, you know, tweed coat, whatever. They're not specific.
Right.
So I'm wondering then, did that matter as much to them? It's not a question that I can really answer.
No,
but
it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, they're, you know, they really want to know what they wore. And the boys are like, well, it's whatever. I don't know, just pants and a sweater.
Very stereotypical male.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to assume that, but yeah. it could be interesting to do that kind of work and, mm-hmm. and figure out the gendered meanings yeah. of clothing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like then you have a lot of next steps and a lot of. Well, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, there's
good.
A lot of really good questions
yeah.
that sort of boil out of this
yeah.
that moving forward you get to explore.
Yes. Yeah,
and you
yeah.
get to do that at Vancouver Island University.
I do. Just very exciting. Yes, I'm happy about that. So
good, and we're all very happy for you. And the University of Ottawa is always excited when people
Yay.
Are successful. It gives hope to the rest of us. So, Catherine Rollwagon, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Sean.
If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.